Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. In this episode, we'll feature the second part of a two-part interview with Natalie Moore and Lance Williams about their book, The Almighty Black Pea Stone Nation: The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But first, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. Media giant Comcast showed a fundamental misunderstanding of free speech last week when it tried to squelch an organization that criticized its political work. But its efforts to stifle a small critic created a bigger problem. Real Girls, a media justice organization based in Seattle, tweeted a message signaling their concern over Comcast's hiring of an FCC commissioner who approved the controversial Comcast-NBC Universal merger just 4 months ago. The problem with this social media strategy? Comcast funds Real Girls, and the media giant seems to be squelching any hint of anti-Comcast messages, even a tweet from an organization with less than 3,000 followers on Twitter. Comcast promptly killed an $18,000 grant that funds Real Girls' summer filmmaking program for young women. Lila Katayev is a technical director for Real Girls.
It really was not a question of, should we not speak out about this issue because of a funder. That did not come up. We felt a right to say things that people needed to hear about these issues, and that it was, in fact, something we needed to do.
Katayev said they were worried when they received the email from Comcast, in part for their own financial situation. But more to the point, she said Comcast's reaction underscores the bigger problems with concentrations of power in general and how the company can stifle free speech so easily.
It's this type of public debate, the tweet that we put out there, that we feel like is threatened to be squelched by mergers like this and really give these large media corporations the power to decide which opinions will see the light of day. That's not a power we were willing to give up.
Within hours of the now infamous tweet and Comcast's reaction, allied organizations rallied around Real Girls and the media jumped on the story. Comcast backtracked and said it would reinstate the funding, but Real Girls declined. Instead, groups like Free Press, the Center for Media Justice, and Magnet helped organize a national fund drive, raising over $14,000 from more than 400 donors in just one day. Katayev says the public support has energized the students participating in Real Girls trainings.
It's really been a teachable moment, too. You know, we're modeling the importance of speaking out to our students, and they're being able to see firsthand how free speech and media consolidation issues affect all of us. And those students are speaking about media justice issues in a way that they never have before. I mean, they're excited, they're fired up, and they're ready to do more.
For more information, visit realgirls.org.
In North Carolina, a new law severely restricts the ability of communities to build their own broadband networks. Pushed through the North Carolina legislature by internet providers Time Warner and CenturyLink, the bill allows existing community networks to continue, but makes it illegal for them to expand into new territory. Brian Bowman is the public affairs manager for the city of Wilson, North Carolina. Wilson has a successful fiber optic network called Greenlight, which now serves 6,000 residents and local businesses.
Our current members don't have to worry about losing any services. We'll continue to provide them. However, we've had quite a few folks from outside Wilson County who have asked about possible partnerships with Wilson, just some ways to try to get that infrastructure to them, because we're the only ones in this part of the state who have an all-fiber network. That can't happen now, so we're pretty much landlocked within our county.
This was the fourth attempt by cable lobbyists to protect their turf by outlawing newer, faster, and cheaper networks.
There were a lot of folks calling this the Monopoly Protection Bill, because essentially what it's going to do, the effect is going to be that a lot of communities in North Carolina, in fact, most communities in North Carolina, will not have a choice now. They'll be stuck with cable if they get it. or DSL if they can get it, and some folks may be stuck with dial-up and satellite for the foreseeable future.
Governor Bev Perdue didn't veto the bill, but made it clear that she wasn't in favor of it. She asked the legislature to revisit the bill to give communities more options.
We do know that the cable companies' lobbyists are very close to a lot of the lawmakers in Raleigh, and they're not going to stop. I imagine that next year they'll come up with a bill that would try to go even deeper into local broadband networks in North Carolina, so I doubt this is over yet. I would be surprised if they'd be willing to give any ground.
Joel Kelsey, a policy analyst for Free Press, says that the North Carolina law is at odds with the federal stance on community broadband. A bipartisan coalition of senators introduced federal legislation to protect community broadband efforts a few years ago. And the National Broadband Plan calls for that protection as well.
I think it is time for the federal government to revisit this question and come in and protect the communities in North Carolina from this ill-founded and corporate-funded legislation, because we know one thing, and that's that the private companies aren't going to go there anytime soon.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
To shovel $1 billion into President Obama's campaign coffers, making promises to rich people and their corporations every step of the way, America's billionaires are spending even more money to seize control of the nation's public schools. Although super wealthy capitalists like Microsoft's Bill Gates, fellow computer mogul Michael Dell, real estate magnate Eli Broad, and the rapacious owners of Walmart, the Walton family, would like people to think of them as philanthropists, they are nothing more than down and dirty investors who hope to reap much more than they sow. This megabuck mafia's goal is to gain access to the $600 billion per year that taxpayers pump into the public schools, and then to profit in perpetuity by shaping the nation's educational system to their corporate needs. The corporate education project has nothing to do with growing new generations of smarter, socially aware, independent-thinking citizens, but is designed to raid public treasuries through wholesale contracting out of public schooling. Teachers are the biggest obstacle standing in the way of the corporate educational coup, which is why the billionaires, eagerly assisted by their servants in the Obama administration, have made demonization and eventual destruction of teachers' unions their top priority. Corporations hate collective bargaining or working people's power of any kind, but their vision goes way beyond simply neutralizing teachers' unions. The billionaires and the politicians they have purchased want nothing less than to destroy teaching as a profession. Plutocrats like Bill Gates and politicians like Barack Obama may make noises about respecting teachers' lifelong commitment to learning, but their actions prove the opposite. At every opportunity, whenever a real or manufactured educational crisis presents itself, the corporate gang champions charter schools and imports platoons of young, mostly white, inexperienced rookies from programs like Teach for America. Most of these neophytes have no intention of making teaching a career, so they accept low wages, turnover is high, and they have no long-term interest in any particular school or school system or the profession in general. They are temporary teachers, which is precisely the point. Just as corporations have revamped the private white-collar workforce, replacing full-time salaried personnel with temporary workers, a system in which some managers are officially temps, such are the prospects for teachers in the brave new corporate world of education reform. The billionaires' propaganda machinery claims the corporatization of American education is necessary to make the United States competitive internationally. But teachers in most of the countries that lead the U.S. in learning are highly respected, if not revered, and relatively well compensated. Under the guise of reform, the United States is moving in exactly the opposite direction as the rest of the world. the American people are being conned by billionaire hustlers who are stealing the public schools and the national future right in front of our eyes. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature the second part of a two-part interview with Natalie Moore and Lance Williams about their book, The Almighty Black Pea Stone Nation, The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang. The following interview was recorded on Sunday, May 15th, 2011. I guess we kind of touched on this a little bit just at the beginning of this interview, and you kind of also reflect this in the title of the book, where you refer to the Almighty Black Pea-Stone Nation, but also referring to it as a gang. Now, it seems to me that it kind of is, it reveals a little bit about your own particular politics as to whether or not you may refer to the Black Pea-Stone Nation as a gang or as an organization. Now, I guess my feeling is if you choose one versus the other, you're basically deciding if you're a supporter, even if it implicitly, or an antagonist, even if implicitly. Or you may just be going along with the flow and just say, well, you know, the news always calls it a gang, so why is it not a gang? Do you feel that this is kind of a mirror about one's own political persuasion, about whether or not you use one word or the other? Or do you think that there's something else at play? Any feelings here?
Well, you know, personally, I prefer as an individual that works with street organizations to use the term as opposed to street gangs because it has more utility. Mm. And it is definitely a political decision. However, I think, you know, from the reality of their existence, I think that they were both. You know, at some points in the evolution, they were organized. At some points, they function as a mere street gang. Mm. And so I think, you know, the title is appropriate because it is the true sense of their existence.
And also, in going back to the title of the book, you're referring to it, I guess, not as a Chicago gang, but as an American gang. Why do you refer to it as an American gang versus a Chicago gang? Obviously, there's some overlap. A Chicago gang is going to be an American gang. But you're emphasizing it in the title, clearly, as an American gang. Why make that choice?
Because the title American sells books. And we want people
out. More readers in America than just Chicago.
We want people outside of Chicago to read it. But seriously, it's a bigger story than just Chicago history. Because mm-hmm. Lance touched on a little bit that domestic terrorism trial. The Elrukins were the first Americans convicted of domestic terrorism in the United States.
When did that happen?
1987.
Wow.
So, you know, there are three major themes in this book. The war on poverty, which we've talked about, a federal program that's helping a Chicago organization, but that's still, you know, U.S. history there. Mm-hmm. The war on drugs. RICO laws were used just for the mob until the early 1980s when Reagan came in office and declared the war on drugs. And the Elrukins were one of the first street organizations to fall to those racketeering charges and convictions. And then the war on terrorism. And that set the precursor for what we're seeing in a post 9/11 world. Mm. So their implications are much bigger than just a bunch of black boys on Chicago South Side hanging out on Woodlawn. And so American also just broadens it out to let people know this is a huge story that plays into federal policy.
Going back to that question of federal policy, another, I guess, phenomenon that's at play certainly with the Black Panther Party, but also with other domestic groups like the American Indian Movement and other groups that were involved in some kind of domestic political involvement outside of just electing one person or another. COINTELPRO, the FBI's controversial counterintelligence program that operated like probably from the mid-50s, ostensibly closed in the early 70s when the word actually became public, but some people argue, maybe convincingly, that the FBI is still doing this sort of thing where they're monitoring domestic political groups.
Really?
and attacking. I am afraid so. I hate to break it to you. But going back from COINTELPRO and its clear involvement in decimating what had been the American Indian Movement and the Black Panther Party and other groups, was there any indication that they were somehow, that the Black Pea Stone Nation may have been a target by COINTELPRO? Do we know anything about this?
Absolutely. We have a whole chapter called 1968 that draws off those FBI files that we receive. So J. Edgar Hoover was afraid of any Negro movement and any Negroes even pretending like they were going to join forces. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of concern that was there that the Stones and the Panthers were going to merge into this super organization and overthrow the government. There are instances where there appears to be people saying things to the government because that's what they want to hear. The FBI, for example, was just dead certain that the Stones were going to disrupt the 1968 Democratic National Convention, which we all know what happened there in Chicago, right. And that the Stones were going to assassinate Hubert Humphrey. Not a single Stone was at the DNC.
What, and yet they were nonetheless paranoid that they were going to, you know, wreak havoc, and
right.
nonetheless, I mean, havoc nonetheless was wreaked, but by a bunch of, you know, white people from the East Coast, not, you know, blacks from the South Side of Chicago. So.
And the other thing is that, you know, these, particularly the Stones, they didn't want to get caught up in some of the mainstream or white political movements. They thought that would bring more heat on them. So, you know, ideologically, they flirted with black power, they were attracted to it, they looked at civil rights, but they never wanted to be in any of those movements exclusively because they knew of the potential heat. And there was also distrust. There were some instances where law enforcement said there was, you know, some white radical who was selling them guns and, you know, out in some rural Illinois location. And, you know, that turned out to not be true either. And it's because the Stones were suspicious. Like, we don't know we should really be cohorting with someone like this. This could even bring more. We already have heat on the organization now. This would just bring more.
I've heard the argument made, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, as to this problem from the point of view of establishment culture in the early 1960s and 70s to defuse this threat of black power movements perhaps merging, perhaps building enough power to be able to seize political power in the United States where they may overthrow the government or win elections or something, where they would translate that organized effort into some kind of political involvement. And the way to defuse that, or at least one argument I've heard to defuse that was the whole point of the drug war, that introducing and inculcating all kinds of drugs into black America was one way to, obviously, if we were going to be nodding out on smack, for example, you're not going to be involved in any kind of political activism of any kind, never mind doing anything that might even be deemed reasonably constructive. Do you feel that this is a fair assessment, or am I off base, or is it more complicated?
Well, I think it's very nuanced, very complicated, as you mentioned. Whatever the situation is, I think when you talk to, particularly talk to folks in the African American community, those are the general sentiments, that the drugs were introduced to the community as a way to kind of derail the civil rights, particularly the Black Power movement. Mm. When we talked to the guys who were members of the Stones, they told us that it was around the end of 68, early 69, that they began to dabble in narcotics and heroin, that it was something that was provided to them, given to them almost for free. Mm-hmm. Prior to that time, it was something that was kind of taboo. They didn't have access to. So, you know, all we can do is kind of report, you know, what we were told. But it is interesting that the narcotics, particularly in the form of heroin, was introduced during the time that the Black Power movement was reaching its peak.
Is there any sense about this being something as a particular tactic to defuse those movements from gaining wider power or adherence, or are they just just an easy way to make a quick buck? Any sense there about its ultimate sense of purpose or function?
Well, you know, those who sold it use it as an opportunity to make a buck.
Of course.
But those who were impacted by it and then think about it retrospectively, see it differently, and they see it as a mistake that the organization, particularly the Stones, are made in participating in a heroin trade, but that it was done intentionally to kind of destroy the movement towards the Black Power movement.
Talk about the legacy of the Black Pistone Nation today. Do we see what it had been as still having some kind of resonance within not just Chicago and maybe even the Chicago political scene, but also for street organizations, if I'll use that term, that are present in Chicago today?
You know, I think the legacy of the Stones is you kind of see an organization that has been hit hard by the war on, particularly the war on drugs. So the whole hierarchy, the leadership hierarchy has been completely decimated. And you find that same situation occurring with other large Black street gangs in Chicago, the same situation with the Disciples, the Gangster Disciples, and the Vice Lords. Essentially what happened after the Stones caught that big domestic terrorism case, which was followed by then the federal government hitting them with racketeering, the RICO law, laws that caused the other leaders right under Jeff Fort, the generals, the El Rukin generals, then were basically indicted and then ultimately convicted and incarcerated. During the time of the fall of those leaders and incarceration of those leaders, the crack cocaine era then begins to kick in, and another type of leadership manifests itself as it relates to street gangs. So when those leaders were taken off of the street, another group of leaders replaced them. But this new group of leadership in the late 80s, early 90s was interested in using the street organization to distribute crack cocaine throughout the city of Chicago. And that changed the culture of the organization. And it went to a drug selling kind of culture, which ultimately destroyed the communities that these individuals were the members lived in. And currently now you have the organization in a renegade state, so to speak, where every little community that has a branch of the Stones basically has its own leadership. And many people would say that because of the drug culture and this fragmented leadership, it contributes to a lot of the violence that you see, because a lot of the fighting over drug turf, it kind of leads to the violence that we see.
And in the wake of all of this current circumstance, it kind of, I guess for lack of a better word, brings things full circle in a sort of way, by which I mean that the whole concern regarding separation from the political process and the continuing economic blight that we had seen on Black America in the 1950s and 60s, which arguably resulted in race riots and the fomenting of groups that organized to combat that and try to get a piece of the pie. Mm-hmm. We're kind of in a similar situation now, but one may argue it could even be worse today. I mean, the Chicago Housing Authority, to mention one example, has had its plan for transformation, which some have argued has probably accelerated trends of homelessness, and where at least if communities could at least have some place home, even if it wasn't a terribly nice home, they at least had a home. Now that's not the case, or far less of the case. Given all of this, that's basically, at least in my point of view, viewing that whole situation as another powder keg, that if some spark of some kind comes along, you could have an explosion, if I could carry the metaphor a little further, but at least you get the idea. Are we seeing things kind of return to where we had been in the 1960s with all of this? Could we see history repeat itself? What are your feelings?
I definitely think so. One of the big lessons in the book was that there's really nothing new under the sun. People act like youth violence is something new. And, you know, anytime a child is caught in crossfire or killed on the streets, that is a terrible thing. However, I think the rhetoric around what we're seeing today, people think that this is something new and that it's never been this way before. Mm-hmm. Well, you look at the Stones and the Disciples, or even look what was happening at the peak of the crack game in Chicago. crime was way worse. Violent crimes, murders were worse 20 years ago. They're cut in half today. But I just give that example to show that some of these same issues still play out. Back in the 60s, the disciples didn't want to go to Hyde Park High School because of boundaries. They didn't want to have to go through stone territory to get to school. Mm-hmm. And we hear some of those same narratives today about kids, their schools closing, they have to go someplace else, and what does that mean for them as far as mobility goes? So I definitely, we see, you know, nothing really changes.
But nonetheless, I think that there's a sense here, or at least a hope, that by telling this story, that we can foster a dialogue, that we can perhaps begin to find or figure out solutions that maybe in the past we didn't have. Is that your hope?
For me, yes. You know, we don't give solutions in the book. It's not a how-to. It's not an anti-gang book. It's a social history. But my hope would be that policymakers, to better understand the city and the way things transpire, that it's a good frame of reference for them as you try to come up for solutions on some of these various urban issues that really tend to repeat themselves.
I'd like to, I guess, from this entirety of what the book is talking about, I'd like to step back a little bit to talk about the book itself and its reception and the media coverage about it. On the website of the book, you list a number of, your press section, which lists interviews and write-ups about the book. What has been your sense about the book and the coverage it's gotten? Have you felt it's been even-handed? Do you feel it's been biased in one or another way, or hasn't been fair? What's your sense about the overall receipt of the book in writ large in the media?
I've been pretty happy with it. Some of the feedback that we get is, I can't believe this book wasn't written.
Right.
There are a lot of people who think they know about the organization. There's a lot of lore around it. And, you know, we try to bring some sanity to the conversation and document things. And as I said earlier, bring context to it. So for me, it's been a rewarding experience. And I'm happy that it's gotten traction.
Yeah, I would say the same thing in terms of the response from mainstream media. But I think we're also interested in how the streets will respond to it, you know, and that you won't get that voice from generally from the media. So just, you know, hearing what people have to say on the streets, guys who are members of the organization, because ultimately it's their narrative, what they think about it. And, you know, we've been pleasantly surprised, you know. You know, this is a reluctant story, a street story, where, you know, people are really sensitive about talking about the Stones or any other street organization because of the culture that goes along with that, or the perception that if you talk about what happens within the organization, you're a snitch. But I think because we have the reputations that we had integrity and relations with folks who were members of the organization or close to the organization, trusted us with the story. So it was important to us that they were comfortable with what we wrote. And so far, so good.
We've been speaking with Natalie Moore and with Lance Williams. They are the co-authors of the new book, The Almighty Black Peacestone Nation, The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang, as well as talking about issues brought up by the book. Natalie and Lance, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
That was the second part of a two-part interview with Natalie Moore and Lance Williams, recorded on May 15, 2011. More information about the book is available online at www.blackstonebook.com. Listen to all past episodes of The Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.